Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Lois Lowry, the Cambridge children's author, is now experiencing what it means to get the Hollywood treatment. More than two decades ago, Lowry published The Giver. It's often described as a dystopian story, and it's become something of a cultural phenomenon. It's even required reading in many schools across the country. Now, 21 years after Lowry's book was published and 18 years after the movie rights were optioned, the book has been turned into a movie with big Hollywood names like Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep. Joining me now in the studio to talk about the evolution of her book and last weekend's release of the movie version of The Giver is Lois Lowry. And besides The Giver, Lois, you have written more than 40 other books. Is that right?
That's right.
So welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So for our listeners who aren't familiar with this long, winding story of your book's trail to the big screen, would you explain what it took so long to get there?
Well, I'm not sure I know all the reasons, but it was Jeff Bridges and his partner at the time, Nikki Silver, who optioned the book. And they thought it would be easy to get it made because it had won the Newbery Medal. It was a very popular book. It was taught in many schools. But I think the thing that was an impediment back then was the fact that it was challenged and banned right from the beginning, frequently. Less so now, incidentally.
What issue did people take with it that made them want to ban it?
Well, they picked things, I think, out of context. There were a couple of scenes that they held up, those who objected to the book. But I think the broader thing that they were objecting to was the fact that it was a fairly dark story and that it depicted a boy challenging the rules of his world and his parents' generation.
We should note for people who haven't read the book or seen the movie, it's basically these. It's a community in which everything is prescribed, what work you do, who you marry, what you're allowed to feel and sense. And so it's that's the dystopian aspect of it.
Yes, but it seems, and the author, moi, tried to make it seem like a utopia. It's a very happy, pleasant, content world until this boy figures out the underbelly.
Now, this movie is coming out after film adaptations of other recent popular dystopian young adult series like The Hunger Games, like Divergent. I noticed about a week or so ago the Wall Street Journal had this little mention of the movie, and it described it as a little late to the dystopian party.
Yes.
Now, you know, that felt to me really not quite accurate, right? Because in a way, your book, at least, was quite early to the party and maybe even set the table to the party. So I'm wondering how you feel sort of hearing the movie portrayed that way.
Well, okay. There was a large canon. I was an English major in college of dystopian literature for adults. They say, and I don't know who they is or if it's true, but they say that The Giver was the first dystopian novel for young adults. It spawned a whole generation of many, many dystopian novels that are out there now. And these two that you mentioned in particular, very popular and very popular movies. Took my book longer to get made, so it comes along behind those. So it's kind of a ice pick to the heart to hear it described that way. But certainly it's true. These other ones came along in movie form first because The Giver took so long.
Did you feel any sense of indignation as these other movies that came after
no,
your book?
No, I didn't because they're very different. I mean, the movie-going public may not realize that. And they may say, well, we won't go to this third one because we've seen the first two. But they are very different. My book was a very quiet, introspective book. No violence, not a lot of action. Some action had to be added by the movie folk. The two that we've mentioned are very action-filled and also filled with violence. So I think they're very different.
Were you able to be involved in any way in the movie-making process?
I was not. They were not obligated to involve me, but somewhat to my surprise, from the beginning, even before they began filming, they started consulting me. They called me a year ago, just about exactly a year ago this past July, and asked me to come out to, actually the director called and said, I want to get together with you. And I, from my hilltop in Maine where I spend summers, said, well, here's how we must do this. You can't get a direct flight to Portland from L.A. You'll have to change planes in Chicago. I'll pick you up at the Portland airport. I will drive you 35 miles to my house. And long silence on the other end. He said,
they were expecting
no,
you to come to California?
No, you will come here. And so I did. And they included me in decisions about the casting, about the set design, about the costumes. I had a Skype interview with the costume designer. And then they took me over to South Africa when they filmed, and then after the filming, into the editing studio in New York.
So quite involved.
So I was very involved, although in a recent interview where the director was sitting beside me and we were asked the question, or I was asked, how much control did you have? I said, none at all. And he interrupted me. He said, actually, you had much more control than you realized. He said, we were listening to everything you said. And I remember one instance in the editing room when the editor played me a scene that I had not seen filmed. And I listened to it and looked at it. And I murmured during it, I hate that one line of dialogue. And next thing I knew, it had been taken out. And that was because the editor had reported to the director that Lowry hates that one line. Huh. And it was a terrible line. Maybe they realized it then.
So quite a lot of influence you had.
Influence, not control. Yeah.
You know, I'm really interested to get your take on what you thought of it. Clearly, you saw bits and pieces of it along the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want to play two little clips in which first we're going to hear the voice of Jeff Bridges playing The Giver. And then we're going to hear the voice of Meryl Streep, who also has a key part. So let's play the first one. This is Bridges.
Who are you?
The Giver.
When the elders need guidance, I provide wisdom using memories of the past. Our world was different.
There was more.
Again, that's Jeff Bridges. Now let's hear the portion with Meryl Streep.
From great suffering, great pain, came a solution. Communities, where disorder became harmony.
So the movie makers get to decide who plays these parts, what their voices will sound like, the tone of their voices. When you heard this, is this what you envisioned in your mind, your characters looking and sounding like?
Jeff Bridges is very close to what I envisioned and heard in my imagination. The Meryl Streep character was much less in the book. She was not developed at all by the author, again, me. But the scriptwriter, the screenwriter, enhanced her character so she becomes much more complex, much more interesting, and it allows for a great deal of conflict with the Bridges character. I love that. I think it's terrific in the movie, and I love the way she plays the role. And I have said on occasion that I wish I could go back and rewrite the book and beef up her character to introduce that element.
So since you can't do that, is there anything you can do? Could it be another? I mean, this is a quartet of books. Could there be a fifth one in which you can elaborate?
Oh, I don't think so. Yeah, I think, no, that quartet is enough of this one particular topic.
I read that one of the things you had said to the filmmakers was, please don't turn this into a teenage romance. Is that right?
That's correct. And the reason I said that is because the three kids, the main characters among the children in the book, are 12. And when I was told that in the movie they were going to age them up, as they say, to about 16, 17, that's when I said, okay, but please don't turn it into a teenage romance. And they have not. I think they've shown considerable restraint. However, it is true that when the boy begins to feel emotions, as he does in the book and in the movie, but in the movie he's 17, of course he's going to feel romantic feelings toward this lovely young girl who plays the role. And so there is a hint of romance, a wistful kind of romance, but we know from the beginning, particularly if we've read the book, that the boy is going to leave and she's going to be left behind. So that's what, I guess, makes it wistful.
So in the end, did you feel that it wasn't as if some, you know, explicit sex scene had been inserted into your book?
No.
Did you feel like you felt like what they eventually did as far as the teen romance was within bounds?
I think it was okay. And there's also an odd little hint. I'm not sure kids will get this hint, that once perhaps there was something between the Meryl Streep character and the Bridges character.
There were some very 21st century touches added. Drones are in this movie. They were not in your 1993 book.
There were planes delivering goods in the book. I hadn't thought of them as drones, but I wrote the book 21 years ago. It was before Amazon told me they were going to make deliveries by drone. So I think the changes were made were probably because it was so much later that the book is then thrust further into the future and certain changes were appropriate.
I want to play just another little piece of tape. This gets a sort of the Hollywoodization, stylization of the movie. And here's a piece, again, between Jonas and the Giver, Jeff Bridges.
Right.
You'll see them all in time, all colors, all differences. Our people chose to do away with emotions. Those morning injections, take them away.
When people have the freedom to choose, they choose wrong.
Tomorrow morning, skip your injection. I've been doing it for months.
We wanted to play that one, not so much for the dialogue as the sound effects. I mean, this is clearly kind of Hollywood sort of, you know, adventure. And could you tell more about how you felt about sort of watching it kind of the Hollywood eyes? Did you end up feeling like it still fairly represented what you created?
I think it does a good job of recreating the intentions of the book. And, you know, until you said you played that for the sound effects, I was listening for the dialogue to make sure it was clear. Of course, a book never has sound effects.
Yeah.
And I watched the movie in progress without any of the added sound, just the dialogue. And so I didn't, until the premiere, the opening of the film, didn't hear it with the full sound effects. I thought they were quite effective.
Did you watch the premiere in just a big theater with a crowd? I mean, where did you see it? Or did you see it quietly in a screening room
on your own? The whole crowd and the red carpet and the paparazzi, the whole thing.
Do you remember
I wore my sluttish silver shoes.
Your red carpet outfit. You know, one more question about the adaptation, and this, I have to warn our listeners, maybe this has a spoiler aspect because it has to do with the sort of very final paragraph of the book. And the Boston Globe movie reviewer who wrote about this, Ty Burr, and I won't say what happens in it, but he does say that treating the final scene literally robs it of what he calls its nagging power. Now, I went back and reread your book, and the final scene does leave to the imagination. Mm-hmm. Wait, what happened there? Did you feel okay about the book being more, or the movie being more literal?
Well, now it can be told, since I heard Harvey Weinstein on the Today Show refer to me as cantankerous. Now it can be told that I argued with Harvey, something few people have the nerve to do. And it was primarily about the ending. He won because he's Harvey Weinstein and I'm not. But I think it's okay. It doesn't have the ambiguity of the book. On the other hand, the book was followed by three others that answer the questions that the ambiguity raised. So most people already know what happened to the boy and the baby.
A question just sort of about you and your life as a writer and your connection to your readers. We know that you keep a blog on your website, and you really, you share very just sort of day-to-day personal anecdotes. You had a funny story about having real estate envy. You saw an apartment somewhere in some publication.
Lust,
exactly.
Yes.
So, you know, do you feel like that's a chance for people to get to know you? Why do you decide to treat your blog in such a personal way?
Well, I live alone with a dog and a cat, so I don't have anybody to talk to except a dog and a cat. So perhaps that's a way of just having a conversation with whatever is out there. I am not as diligent about keeping the blog as I should be. I used to be in the beginning. But I don't know. I sit there alone and I just talk to myself. And because I'm at a computer, it goes out there into the atmosphere for people to know what I'm saying to myself.
Do you get a lot of reader feedback or movie watching feedback in the past week?
You know, well, it's starting to come in now that people are seeing the movie. I always have gotten a lot of reader feedback. It's so easy for a reader now to reach an author. They can email me through my website. And they do.
And you're open to that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, we mentioned that The Giver is required reading in a lot of schools. And so in many ways, that has shaped sort of the interests of a certain young reading generation. How do you feel being an author who often, I remember my husband's a teacher. I know his mm-hmm. entire seventh grade at his school was reading The Giver. Mm-hmm. How does it feel to be one of those authors whose books become required reading?
Well, it's a kind of an amazing feeling of responsibility toward those kids. I will say that I think every generation has their iconic anti-establishment book. And for me, it was The Catcher in the Rye, which was published when I was 14. For my kids, it was Vonnegut and perhaps Joseph Heller with Catch-22. The book that lets kids know that the older generation didn't get it right. and I think that The Giver has been that for a lot of kids.
It is interesting that while some people call it dystopian, early in our conversation you said really more utopian is the goal. And in fact, I think you've said you're not really trying to teach moral lessons. It's not supposed to be
I think a book that has messages and becomes didactic is bound to fail. Kids don't want to hear lessons and messages in books. They want to hear a good story. That's what I try to write.
So when you wrote The Giver, that's what you had in mind, an interesting story, not one that was supposed to have some profound, overarching message to young
people. No, that's exactly right. It's very interesting to me that people find mind messages in it. And that's okay. That's the way it should be, I suppose, but because people get different things from it, not what I tried to teach them.
Huh. By the way, has your life the past few months just been consumed by movie marketing and interviews?
Hooray for Hollywood, yes. I had 72 interviews in one day out in Los Angeles.
72?
72.
Back to back with you in a hotel lobby
or
something
like that?
4 minutes
apiece, yes. Yes, you got that right. But now the movie is open and out there, and I'm finished with having to promote it, and I'm back on my hilltop with my dog and my cat.
Well, considering that you did 72 interviews in one day, I hope we came up with some questions today for you that you hadn't interviewed, that you hadn't been asked
this
before.
This was very pleasant, yes.
Thank you. Lois Lowry, thank you so much for coming in. Lois Lowry, who lives in Cambridge and also spends time in Maine, is the author of The Giver and 40 other books. The Giver won the Newbery Medal. It's now been made into a movie that came out last week. Again, thank you for coming to the studio. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Fun for me. Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.